to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Gary Bennett, who's a professor of psychology, global health, and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Gary Bennett.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And the mayor of New York, of course, has gone through something of a public humiliation since he banned the big sugary soda drinks, and then a judge overturned that ban. So how do you see this? Is this a victory of big business over big government?
Well, I think it's probably a bit premature to call a victory for either side at this point. Our primary concern here is that we don't think the original measure really went quite far enough. And my concern is that the mayor and those of us who are interested in policy strategies to contend with the obesity epidemic really may have spent too much political capital on this initiative that we think probably was unlikely to make a major dent in obesity rates anyway.
Well, but wasn't there a statewide effort to ban or to bring in a soda tax, I should say, and that got clobbered by the big food lobby?
Yeah, indeed it did. Unfortunately, though, when we look at the kinds of policy solutions that are most likely to make an impact on the weight of the community, it really is the things like the surcharges for sugary beverages. The kind of initiative that the mayor advocated was a good measure, but probably best included as part of a comprehensive package of policy strategies. On its own, I think it was probably unlikely to make a major impact. And as I said, we really need popular support and strong political support for these kinds of initiatives. And I'm afraid that after all that's happened with the New York proposal, we may have a lost ground on that.
Well, there were, of course, some inconsistencies in the ban, not to justify the judge's ruling, because it seemed to be all over the place in some parts, suggesting that the ban wasn't strict enough, and then the other parts of this poorly written argument by Judge Tingling that it was hurting business, as though Coca-Cola and companies like that are on the ropes. But the fact that milkshakes are okay, you can still go to the 7-Eleven and get the massive 64-ounce infusion of sugar because that's regulated by the state, not the city, et cetera. So it seemed to me that there were some serious flaws, shall we say, in the mayor's proposal.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the food industry's argument, just to start with, was specious at best. We heard the same kind of things from the tobacco lobby years ago, that businesses were going to be harmed, that the industry was going to be harmed. And really, I think that was not true, was not the case. And I think it's quite unlikely that the industry's position was really a valid one in this regard as well. But to reflect on your point a bit, the value of a measure like this, I think, is primarily to change the way that people think about their beverage consumption. And the real value is in changing what we call social norms, or the kinds of attitudes and perspectives that people have on their food consumption behaviors. And unfortunately, though, I think you're right that the measure itself in practice was going to be rather confusing. There were some things that were in and some things that were out and some things that were regulated by some parties and others not. And some days you could have a coffee drink and couldn't have a soda. So I think that my concern really was that in practice, the confusion caused by the ban in many respects acted against its potential in changing the population's norms. And look, I applaud Mayor Bloomberg for taking this on. He has been an advocate for public health for a long time, and I know his heart's in the right place. I just think that this measure was probably not the right one as the first big initiative in the obesity policy space.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Bandich, who's a professor of psychology, global health and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. So in terms of biobehavioral health disparities research, not that I'm anything of an expert. In fact, it's the first time I've heard the term. But
it doesn't exactly ring off the tongue.
Exactly. But in terms of disparities, at least, the issue is, it seems so much tied to poverty. And it is the most obese people in this country tend to be poor or lowly paid, single mothers with a bunch of kids that they've got to feed, sometimes on food stamps, and the sugary, fat-laden, salt-laden corporate food goes further and gives the family the illusion of nutrition and sustenance. Isn't that the heart of the problem?
It's certainly a major contributor to the problem. There's no question about it. Right now, the most palatable foods that are in ready supply are inexpensive, and they happen to be those that are most processed and most energy dense. And that's a real problem. You know, the kinds of foods that we know to be associated with normal weight and weight loss, leafy vegetables, fruits, those kinds of foods, are rather expensive. They remain expensive, and they're just plain not as accessible to the most socioeconomically disadvantaged people in our society. And that's a major concern and a major contributor to the obesity epidemic. So, you know, one of our concerns about the measure, the New York measure, is that we like when we have policies that restrict access, like the soda ban, we like to pair those with measures that make healthful choices easy for people to make. And that actually was a major concern with the ban. It would have been, as part of a comprehensive package of policy solutions, perhaps a set of policies that might have resulted in incentivizing more healthful foods or lowering prices or adding additional incentives to retailers to make more widely available healthful foods. This kind of policy would make sense. But again, on its own, restricting access has the potential of being unnecessarily regressive and actually harming those at the lowest ends of the socioeconomic spectrum.
So, Dr. Gary Bandich, what can be done, though, in terms of grassroots political organization to counter the power and wealth of the corporate food industry? And if you just go back to the statewide soda ban that was literally hammered into extinction by big companies like Coca-Cola. For example, they got the NAACP to endorse their efforts in spite of the fact that African Americans have a higher rate than average of obesity. So isn't this, I mean, at least it leads me to see that the playing field's not level in terms of propaganda, information, public relations, you name it, education, whatever you want to call it. The food industry has got a bigger megaphone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the incentives are misaligned right now. We know that the food industry are major donors to many of the civic and non-governmental and advocacy organizations that lobby on behalf of the very folks who are most disproportionately affected by obesity. And so I think really what we need to see more frequently is public advocacy and really public clamoring for advocacy organizations to strike a harder bargain with the food industry. I mean, you're very right about the NAACP and other organizations. And in fact, in many respects, they are in a very well positioned to make these kinds of arguments on behalf of the communities that they serve. And so I think really we need to see more public clamoring for this kind of thing. You know, it's also the case that consumer demand really matters. And I think we have underestimated the impact of consumer demand on changing industry practices. If I asked you 15 years ago how many different brands of organic milk were you able to find in your local supermarket, you'd probably tell me none, and maybe one. But now you'll have 3, 4, or 5 different brands of organic milk alone, and that's a function of increased public demand, consumer demand for those kinds of products. We need to see the very same thing for healthful products being made more widely available in supermarkets across the country. And what's even more important is that we see public We see public advocacy activity on behalf of increasing access to healthful foods and ensuring that supermarkets are full-service supermarkets are widely accessible by the populations who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. You can look at organizations like the Food Trust in Pennsylvania, which has as part of its mission increasing access to full-service supermarkets in low-income areas throughout Pennsylvania. It's been a hugely successful initiative, public-private partnerships, lots of involvement from the academic research community, and they're really making a difference. We need to see more initiatives like that. And if we did, I think we'd be able to see change in the weight of the communities that are really most affected.
So, Dr. Gary Bennett, the big food corporations, apparently their profits are in the trillions and per year. And there's a book out I interviewed recently, Michael Moss, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. I think it's called Salt, Sugar, Fat.
Right.
And he describes how back in, I think, 1999, the CEOs of all the big food corporations met at Pillsbury headquarters and were given a briefing about how their food is responsible for the obesity epidemic. And rather than deal with it honestly, they came up with all kinds of ways to take fat out, to put sugar in, to relabel, etc. So it seems to me that if the public realized how much the epidemic of obesity actually costs them in terms of medical costs because of the costs of obesity and diabetes and heart disease, you can look at the figures. I mean, trillions of profit for the food industry, and I believe obesity and diabetes, I think the costs are about $600 billion a year, most of which is borne ultimately by the taxpayer. So isn't that a way for the average American to recognize they've got a dog in this fight?
Absolutely. Look, you know, with all the discussion in D.C. right now about spending and cost-cutting measures and the like, you know, our obesity epidemic is a non-trivial contributor to our rising healthcare costs. There's really no question about it. And if we look at the primary drivers of obesity in American society anyway, there's really no question that the widespread availability of processed foods and foods consumed away from home, you know, also called fast food, are major drivers of our obesity epidemic. There's just really no question about that. I don't think there's any credible, really no credible evidence to the contrary. Yes, it's definitely the case that our interest in having easily accessible fat-laden, sugar-laden foods are both causing our waistlines to increase, and they're also costing us money. And they're going to continue to cost us money. You know, my concern really is that they will continue to negatively impact our productivity in this country, decrease our military readiness, I mean, and continue to cost us money in ways that are really quite unexpected, you know, continuing to cost us more money at the pumps and more money on our airplane tickets because of the gas charges. There are a whole host of costs, both direct and indirect and hidden and not so hidden, that are directly related to our increasing waistlines. So I think this is a major societal problem and really a crisis, and it does require us to each take stock of what we're eating and how we're eating and to think about the long-term consequences both to our health and to our nation.
So, Dr. Gary Bennett, then, how much of this is in terms of Mayor Bloomberg and his defeat by the state judge, who's apparently running for re-election, and of course Mayor Bloomberg is 10 years almost up? Is it a case of the wrong messenger, in as much as you know you've got a billionaire who's sort of lecturing to a bunch of poor people who simply, you know, don't have the education or the financial wherewithal to make the right choices? Is there a possibility of a better spokesperson, of somebody that can really engage the victims of this bad diet that corporate America is foisting on them?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the example of Mayor Bloomberg, you know, for those of us in the public health community, Mayor Bloomberg has long been known as a really vocal advocate and proponent for public health concerns. and he's done so at times when public health really was not particularly an attractive area in which to invest. So I think that Mayor Bloomberg has an appropriate, as I said before, his heart's in the right place, and his has a bully pulpit in a big way as a third-term mayor who is a billionaire and is probably unabashed in many respects. That said, the obesity epidemic is too big and too intractable and too linked to too many different parts of American society for us to have and just one spokesperson. And so it's going to take efforts from the First Lady and from Mayor Bloomberg and from civic actors and from researchers. It's going to take more spokespeople for this kind of, for us to win this battle. You know, if we look back at our efforts to combat the tobacco industry, there were lots. That was a long, long marathon battle, and there were lots of ups and downs, and many times in that looked just like this one, when individual jurisdictions and individual judges turned down different actions that municipalities were interested in enacting. And so I think that the obesity policy strategies will live to fight another day. My hope is that that this will become a more of a broad-based effort, and that we'll see more communities take on initiatives like this. If you, again, use the tobacco control as an example, what really we all believe that tobacco control policies were directly related to the decrease in smoking in this country. But we got there because municipalities across the country, communities all across our nation, argued for tobacco bans, and we're still seeing those today. So my hope is that we'll have some more inspired policy solutions, perhaps by smaller communities that are disproportionately affected by obesity, that will begin to pass this kind of legislation so that it becomes normative. Starting in New York is potentially a good idea, but again, I think it's really going to have to happen across the country for us to make a major dent in the obesity epidemic.
Well, Dr. Gary Bennett, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your interest.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Gary Bennett, who's a professor of psychology, global health, and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm